Paceline is a production of the Cycling Independent with generous support from our subscribers and with additional underwriting from Shimano North America. From the Cycling Independent, this is The Paceline, the podcast on two wheels. I'm Patrick Brady, and with me is my co-host, John Lewis. Each week, we take a look at how cycling fits in our lives. Is this the week coming up to Holy Week, or are we, we're in Holy Week relative
to the... We are in Cycling Holy Week. Tour of Flanders took place last weekend. With Paris-Roubaix coming this weekend, the two Flanders races were dynamite. The women's race was won by a rider who is touted as a possible race winner all the time. But she hasn't... Well, she's already won a race this year, but as long as I've been watching her race... Well... Let's say she burst onto the scene and everyone was like, she's the next big thing. And then she was not. But we've been talking about her a lot for a long time. And she now seems to be coming good. It's Elisa Longoborghini, the Italian. She won the race in a three-way sprint, which was pretty exciting. On the men's side, it was Mathieu van der Poel. The men's race was really a strange one to watch. I mean, first of all, I should say that it was rainy in Flanders, which made for a classic. And what basically happened was, I'm going to forget whether it was the Koppenberg, but it might have been one of the other cobbled climbs, the Hellingen, they call them, I guess. There was a rider who had spun out, I guess. He thought he had dropped a chain, but he had not. He had just spun out. And so he was standing there. And as the peloton got to him, then everyone except basically Vanderpoel and Mads Pedersen spun out. Like, you basically, the entire peloton, if Vanderpoel looked over his shoulder, he'd see everyone with a bike on their shoulder or pushing their bike in their tippy tappy shoes trying to walk up the climb. It was crazy. And then he just rode away and won it.
Well, I mean, when you can ride away, that's very often what happens.
Yeah.
It's a neat trick. Show your friends.
If I had that trick, my friends would have seen it. Believe me.
Very good. Well, I miss watching rainy races, so I'm going to have to go look that up.
You should look it up. Both races were good. I'm not telling people to go watch pro racing, but I'm not telling them.
Okay. All right. Yes. One question. Longoborghini.
Yeah.
Longo. Any relation?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, moving right along, what's your pull getting into today?
It was a weird week in the bike industry. Not everyone listening reads Bicycle Retailer the way I do. You got to be either in the business, and a lot of the people I know in the business don't read it either. You got to be pretty deep to want to go there. Not that they do a bad job. It's just, you know, it's an industry rag. Anyway, so first came the news that Scott Sports had fired their longtime owner and CEO, Beat Zaug. Now, a controlling interest in the company, he used to own it outright, or he used to own 50-something percent of it. but a controlling interest in the company was purchased by Korea's Yongon. I'm going to say it wrong. I don't know if there's Yongone or Yongwon, or I don't know what it is. It looks like Yongwon. Mm-hmm. They bought a controlling interest in 2015. So they're a supplier to brands like Scott, Patagonia, Adidas, the North Face. They have factories in Korea, Bangladesh, China, Vietnam, Thailand. They are also the majority owner of the outdoor clothing brand Outdoor Research.
Wow.
So this, all of this information, by the way, is via Steve Frothingham at Bicycle Retailer. This is not my original reporting. It's his. Mm-hmm. And a CEO getting fired, especially after the industry has gone through a supply chain meltdown, as it has over the last couple years, isn't that strange. What was weird about this was that Zhao then came out and said, basically, nope, I'm not fired. I'm still in charge.
Yeah. I've been waiting for the follow up to this. I haven't had a chance to go look.
I know, right?
But like, you see that other
shoe,
you know, that the gif of Michael Jackson eating the popcorn.
Yeah,
I commented that on a friend's page. I was like, oh, I can't wait to see more.
Yeah. The other shoe has to drop. So, and then there was some public back and forth between him and the Scott board, which made them all look pretty dumb, I thought.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. As I said, I'm not here to report on the situation. Steve already did that. He's on top of the news. I'll be looking, as you said, for the next update. But what I want to talk about today is it got me thinking about brand capital and customer loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
And how those things often line up in weird and inexplicable ways.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's increasingly difficult to keep up with who owns what.
Yeah.
Who's responsible for making the good stuff that a company sells. Mm-hmm. And who's just jumping in with some, quote, smart money to try to align their market strategy via a consolidation of category verticals. And gain efficiencies always, or synergies.
Yeah.
And if that sounds like word salad to you, you haven't read many corporate acquisition press releases, because that's exactly what they sound like.
That is the vocabulary.
Yes. To illustrate this conundrum, I'm going to go kind of to the other end of the spectrum, because it's a history that I watched from right close by. I'm going to use an example from the custom bike world, mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk about the company Independent Fabrication.
That's quite the tale.
Yes. If you don't know who they are or were, I'll just say that at one time they made an awful lot of steel road and cyclocross bikes, and that a lot of very cool people worked there at one stage or another.
Mm-hmm.
For the mm-hmm. true nerds, IndyFab was one of the offshoots from Fat Chance Cycles, which was itself one of the primogenitors of the second wave of American bike building.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you're going to jump in and correct me in anywhere I go astray here, but
you're doing fine.
Yeah, so far so good. So IndyFab is a company with a number of distinct stages. There was a group of original founders who were a bunch of knuckleheads with an eye for design and some legit machining, welding, and painting chops.
Mm-hmm.
They called themselves Independent Fabrication because the people who worked there owned it and operated it.
Yep.
As it turned out, and I know a few of them and have heard the stories, as it turned out, they were, in fact, knuckleheads. They weren't the best at the business part of bike building. So eventually, some money was needed from outside. Mm-hmm. This marked the second phase of the company, which was eventually moved out of Somerville, Massachusetts, to southern New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
That move left behind the founders, all of them, I think all of them had gone by the time the company was purchased. And that machination took a few years. I'm skipping over a lot of details, but So the founders are all gone at that point. A number of the talented builders who came later, like Jamie and Tyler from Firefly, who had been involved up to that point, were also like, yeah, peace out. No thanks. So you had this early stage where IF has captured lightning in a bottle and people want to buy their bikes, myself included. There's a cool factor. This is them building brand capital, right? Mm-hmm. This is them creating the covetable product that people associate with independent fabrication. In the second phase, the new owner, who's not a bike builder, decides he can go on building bikes with whomever he can get to relocate to New Hampshire and sell people an IF that is just like the ones built in Massachusetts. But that doesn't go very well for reasons that should mostly be clear. The value of a brand is in the people who create it, not in the name alone or in the corporate decision making that goes on separate from the creative part of the endeavor. Mm-hmm. Have I said anything controversial?
Not controversial. Well, I mean, somebody from private equity would go, no, you're all wrong about that. But we'll come back to that at some point. Yeah. Yeah. No,
of course they would. You're doing fine. That's my point.
Yes. Yes. I figured. Yeah.
So today, that company is in a third phase. The factory in southern New Hampshire is gone. That same person also bought Bailey Works bags. By the way, which is, I think, also gone the way of all things. But I'm not actually sure who owns the IF name now. Last I checked, there was a rented office somewhere in New Hampshire, not a factory. I don't know who is building their bikes, if anyone is. All of this is not to say that a bike you might get from them today, if that's even still possible, is a bad bike. I don't know. I want to be clear about that. What I'm saying is that what you could get today is decidedly not what you would have gotten 15 or 20 years ago, though it might carry the same logo. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And across the industry, this is true. Mm-hmm. And as outside money acquires bike companies in distress, and there are plenty of them around, the nature of what they do changes. The way they do it changes. And often the products that ensue are not the products upon which the brand was built. Mm-hmm. So for consumers, it can be so hard to understand what you're actually buying. And, you know, some people probably don't care. They just want the name for whatever reason. And that's fine, I guess. Like if you're just collecting stuff or I don't relate to that point of view, but I'm not judging it. I'm just saying that for those of us who want the thing to be the thing, it can be pretty tough to figure out if the thing is still the thing anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I find myself quite often saying, oh, you know, I've always wanted this thing, and I'll have a little discretionary income. So I'll go do a little bit of research. I'll find out, well, the people who made that thing aren't the people who make that thing anymore. Mm-hmm. And they don't make it where they used to make it, and they don't make it how they used to make it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's actually not that thing anymore. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's like, maybe that's where nostalgia goes to die. You know what I mean? And maybe that's okay. Like, maybe that puts us all facing forward instead of nostalgically glancing backwards. But, I mean, do you think this stuff is important? How hard do you feel it is to navigate all that information as you decide what bikes and bike parts to invest in?
It's become incredibly difficult. And yeah, it does matter to me. And I wrote a post for Belgium Knee Warmers. You know, we're talking like 18 years ago now. The Soul of the Machine was the title of the post. Right. And it went into, as a matter of fact, it even dealt with IndieFab and Fat City as kind of its case study, you know, contemplating, well, what's in a brand? What is the brand? And contemplating the very question you're taking on right now. And, you know, at the time, so Chris Chance had just run into a load of problems. Fat City was not especially well managed. And the company that had purchased Serata purchased Fat City. And so suddenly Fat City bikes were coming out of Cerrada. And Cerrada stopped making their own mountain bikes. And so all the Cerrada mountain bikes were decaled Fat Chance. And then everybody who'd been doing all the work on, the Fat Chances back when they were still in Somerville. Yeah. They launched Indy Fab with help from the city of Somerville. And you know, it was a really interesting thing. And as someone who, reviewed bikes from both, you know, Fat City and Indy Fab, you know, I don't know that I could have told you a difference other than the paint job. They were both very, very well-made bikes. But, you know, cycling is, it's an endeavor that for most of us, I think, is fueled largely by passion, emotion, and we want to feel some sort of connection to our bike. I'm not somebody who goes around naming things. I don't name my bikes. I don't name my cars.
Right.
You know, so I don't have that level of whatever frou-frou. I not to knock anyone who does it. I'm not that guy, but I still have a strong emotional connection with all of my bikes, even my silly little, it's not little and it's not silly, but my cargo e-bike. I have really strong feelings about how wonderful that machine is. But you know, when I buy a bike, I want to feel like I know what it is I'm buying. And for me, that is absolutely, it's an investment in the people. And so it's very important to me. You know, to use another example, a little closer to home for both of us, since we own some or at least one of their bikes, Ibis. So after Ibis originally got into trouble back in the mid-90s, I want to say, mid to late 90s, they got into some trouble and they ended up being purchased by, I want to say, some form of private equity, and Scott got pushed out or left. I forget whose impulse power he was on when that took place. But there was a period of time where Scott Nickel was not involved in Ibis, and the people who owned it were not bike industry people. And to say they ran it into the ground is a little bit like saying that one of those 737 Maxes failed to land. You know, it didn't just run into the ground. It, you know, anyway, that's a little dark.
It was. I was going to let you go, though. I like it.
But, you know, bike industry people got back involved with Ibis. They managed to purchase the name back. Scott Nickel is involved. He's very much a part of the company. He handles his duties are things that he's really good at. So when it comes to managing the books and things like that, that's, as I understand it, not really his area of expertise. But, you know, Ibis, I feel like the soul of that operation is there. And plus, I've also met, you know, most of their employees. There aren't very many. They're good people. I'm happy to hand them my sawbucks.
Yeah. I think everything you said jibes with what I think. And I want to be clear that, you know, corporate money or investor money isn't always bad. I think in the best cases, people with management know-how come in and say, we're going to take care of this piece so you can actually do what you're good at. The problem for me is when corporate money comes in and says, well, actually, the quality of the product or the innovation or the inspiration doesn't really matter. What we have is a whole piggy bank full of brand capital, and we're going to slap logos on it and jack our throughput up as high as we can and suck the cash out of this thing. That's how a lot of businesses run. It's just not those just aren't the products I want to buy myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a big problem with that for a couple of reasons. You know, one, yeah, I don't want to be giving money to people who are only involved to suck profit out for the shareholders. I like giving my money to companies that keep good people employed. And that's one of the things that I've really struggled with the move of Camelback and Giro and Bell and Blackburn and, you know, a host of other brands to Southern California. For the record, as someone noted to me, all the original people at Camelback had been long gone because that brand had been sold. But they had built, you know, a good and capable staff. I know people there. And all of those people, by and large, gone. And they're living in Petaluma or Santa Rosa or, you know, wherever. And now that brand is down in Irvine. I don't really know what to make of it, except it doesn't excite me. You know, the people who did such an impressive job designing the helmets for Bell and Giro, disposable. Mm. I have not just an ethical issue with that. I have a moral issue with that. And this comes back to Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize winning economist who said nothing matters but shareholder value. There's not going to be any shareholder value at some point if everybody keeps up with this. Yeah. And all those of us who've helped build these companies end up unemployed.
Yeah. I mean, there are plenty of companies that I was loyal to for a long time that I look at now and I'm like, what would I even be loyal to? I don't even know why I would continue buying your products.
Yeah. Because of my position in the industry, I have the ability to just call up companies and talk to them. That's not generally how I get to know folks, though it's happened. Not this most recent, but the previous iteration of Indy Fab that moved to New Hampshire. I knew their CEO. He did not trust me initially. He was very suspicious of me. And I proved myself as someone who just wanted to write a good story. And I treated him fairly. And I see both sides of what that short-term meltdown was before other bigger things took place. And that was a sad thing to see. I didn't think there were any villains.
Yeah, I didn't. I left the name. I left most of the names out because I don't think it's about like this person is bad or that person is bad. With that story, my point was only really that what you were buying in the first phase was a product of some very specific people's creativity, passion, and style.
Yeah.
And then what you bought in the second phase was not. I don't know that it was good or bad, but it was not the original thing. That's my point.
Yeah.
And this happens over and over again. And a lot of cases, I don't need to find out if your new phase is good or not. Like, actually, we're at reset. I'm not going to be loyal to the new phase because I don't even know what it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know who designed the products. I don't know where they're coming from. I don't know why. I don't know why I would buy it. Mm-hmm. So I find myself, and there's something refreshing about it, I guess. Like, oh, I don't have to just buy that brand of helmet anymore because because my friends work there and I like them and I know what they did and I know why they did it. I guess I'm gonna go try new stuff now, which is fine. It's good, but I am constantly kind of looking for something stable and inspiring and well done to support.
Yeah. I hear you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had met the guys from Number 22 at the North American Handmade Bicycle Show and had gotten to know them just a little bit. Got to know them a lot more once I decided to buy a bike from them. And you know, Lordy, it's just nice to buy something from good people.
I mean, I think it's nice to buy something from people.
Not to put too fine a point on it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm yeah. Okay. We've been around that tree and tied the ribbon. So
yes. Alrighty. We're going to take a brief break and we will come back in just a minute. The Pace Line is sponsored by Shimano North America and their new 12-speed GRX mechanical group sets. Gravel cycling shouldn't be overly complicated. The heart and soul of cycling's drop bar dirt road discipline is simplicity, inclusivity, and adventure. No ride is out of bounds. All are welcome to join. Gear should be functional, reliable, and not break the bank. These are the core ideas behind Shimano's 12-speed GRX mechanical groups. Find out more at gravel.shimano.com.
Okay, we're back with the Pace Line, the podcast on two wheels. What's your pull for us this week?
You're not going to believe this. I got asked a question by a friend recently, and it was a bit of a surprise. Because I can't recall if anyone has ever asked me this question before. That's not entirely true. Certainly people who weren't cyclists had asked me the question, but cyclists, I don't think, had ever asked me the question before. The question being, why would I ever want to do a group ride in a Peloton? Okay. We're not talking about whether or not someone might want to do an organized ride or a charity ride. This is about riding in a compact group, a Peloton. The person who asked me saw little more than an opportunity to crash and to be forced to go far harder than they wanted or to face the prospect of riding alone. And they observed that they don't need to be dropped by a group to ride alone.
Sure.
That was certainly I think they call it inarguable point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Truly, initially I was kind of flummoxed because I see the appeal of doing a group ride as being prima facie fun. That is, the fun that it represents is obvious, at least to me.
Sure.
But that's not the case for everyone. And I always accept that the things that I like are not ever universal in appeal. Usually the things I like are fairly narrow in appeal. why it is? Honestly, the question has several answers, though one of them trumps all of the rest. And I'm going to go up in ascending level of convincingness. If being competitive is of any interest, learning how to ride in a group is kind of necessary. Unless the whole of your interest is in time trialing, and even group riding will help you get faster for time trial. So I see it as just a necessary condition. My second reason, and this is a better reason, is that if you want to become fit, doing group rides will make you very fit, more fit than you will easily achieve on your own.
That is my experience.
Yeah. The hardest I have ever worked has been when I needed to stay on the wheel of someone stronger than me. I have turned myself inside out in those efforts. I've pinched nerves, as a matter of fact, in those efforts. Maybe not the best selling point right now, but no. Yeah. You will also ride more miles in a week, in part by going on rides longer than you might have done on your own. So I think those are pretty compelling reasons.
It's true. And I think actually that last thing about riding more miles, it's not because you are able to ride more miles because you're in a draft more often.
That
it isn't
certainly
just
helps.
A case of being forced to do something. But
yeah,
I'm putting my chocolate in your peanut butter. Please continue.
And we like that. Yeah. A still better reason, I think, is that it is social. There aren't a lot of ways to exercise and be social at the same time. I've had long conversations while on group rides, some of them reasonably intimate at that. And there's something about group rides that will definitely promote more open conversation. But the best argument for group rides that I have is flow. If you want to find flow to enter a flow state, the unpredictability of a group ride will keep you in the moment, and the combination of watching people moving around in your peripheral vision, the speed, and your effort will combine to produce optimal conditions for flow. You've got a couple of flow triggers right there, just in that alone. And it even gets better than that. Group flow is something that is very hard to achieve. I don't talk about group flow very much because it's in short supply. Mm-hmm. Because there are several conditions that have to be met for that to be a possibility, whether or not it actually happens. You've got to be, all the people involved have to be of a similar level of ability and to be really tuned in to each other. Not just emotionally, but like in space, you've got to have kind of a sixth sense about where everyone is relative to each other. And that happens in group flow. And guess what? Group rides serve as an ideal crucible for group flow. The fact that most group rides don't suffer crashes every single ride speaks, I think, to just how prevalent group flow is within them. I've found myself in situations that didn't result in a crash that, to me, can only be explained by group flow. Mm. I also have some backup for this. So some years back when I was working on the feature that I wrote for Bicycling Magazine about flow, the science of Hui, I got to have a long conversation with neuroscientist Leslie Sherlin. And one of the points we discussed regarding flow was how just weeks before, I want to say maybe a couple months before, a study had been released, published, that showed athletes are more likely to enter flow at around 80% of their max heart rate. And we agreed. I had kind of my pet theory and he bore it out. It fits within the skills challenge matrix for flow, because flow is a balance of skill versus challenge. And so an 80% effort, what coaches often call tempo, is hard, but you're not dying. You're not wondering how much longer you can hold on. It's hard, but you can keep doing this for a while. And it feels mm-hmm. good to be going that hard. Mm-hmm. Well, you talk to cycling coaches about the problem of the tempo group ride, and they're like, it's the worst thing ever. You talk to a coach, and the last thing in the world they want you to do is ride at 80%. Because it's right. hard enough to feel like training without actually being hard enough to make a fit rider stronger. So to me, the answer is obvious. Riders default to this because flow is more important than actual fitness.
Yeah. Yes. So, yes.
I think it proves its own point.
Yeah. I mean, this jibes so closely with my experience in so many ways. You know, like right now I'm training for a running event.
God help you.
And one of the challenges of the training is that we need to be running slowly for a long mm-hmm. period of time. Mm-hmm. But what feels best is what I call an orange run. And an orange run is a run where you're not in the red.
Oh, uh-huh.
You're not in the red, but you're working, you know, like you're
it's
right
not a
in
jog.
That.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're right in that sweet spot of effort where you're not blowing up, but you're at your sort of fullest, most like the most comfortable full capacity there is.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
That's about 80%. Yep.
Right.
Yep. That is tempo.
We also, you know, I also do this thing called Suffer Club twice a week, which is group workouts that involve, you know, all manner of functional exercise. And people really want to have their asses kicked. And the group members aren't, you know, they're not, no one is throwing up. No one is going, no one is doing
full rhabdo.
Yeah. But they want to be at that 80%. And as a lot of us are older, and I think this becomes even more important the older you get. I only have probably two of those big efforts in me a week. And the rest needs to be different. So this is if you're trying to achieve fitness.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like to be fit, but not at the expense of fun. And that's where flow and that, you know, that's the kind of the loop back to that group ride.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, if we take out our understanding of flow being fun, and look at the deeper rewards that it pays, you know, not looking at it through the, you know, bike riding is fun lens. Flow is routinely reported to be the single most rewarding experience that we have. I mean, you know, childbirth and, you know, other stuff. Okay, yeah, those are big, huge moments. But in terms of the things that bring us satisfaction in our lives, and make us feel like we're on the right track in our lives, flow is a big, big piece of that. And, you know, a lot of us have careers where finding flow in work can be a challenge. And so our play life is an opportunity to get that fix in a way that can be hard to secure otherwise in our lives.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the caveats I would have around people going to those big group rides, and especially if they feel reticent about it, because, you know, my wife rides, but not in a group, but not in, and she, the idea of a Peloton just gives her the howling fantods. And so I get that there's a certain level of confidence you need in order to navigate that space. And it's one of those chicken or the egg things, right? It's hard to get the skill without practicing the skill, right? So,
yep.
You know, how are you going to get confident enough to ride in a Peloton if you never ride in a Peloton? But I think it's very worth it. And I'm going to give a really bizarre example.
Okay.
The grocery store.
I can't wait to hear where this goes.
Yeah. So I think about the grocery store all the time, because I think actually the grocery store is this sort of microcosm of society. And, you know, because there are all of these, you know, we're interacting. So there's a social component. There's what the grocery store has, what I call a physical politics, just like a group ride. So I'm in the aisle and I've got my cart, and people are in the same aisle with their carts, and they're trying to get their stuff and I'm trying to get my stuff.
Yeah.
And there are certain people who, despite having walked into a store full of people with grocery carts, are completely oblivious to the fact that there are other people with grocery carts around them.
Oh, now I'm getting a feel for where this is going.
And I think that at root, they've just never developed a spatial awareness that allows them to see other people. So they're either sociopaths, which I often think, or they just don't have this spatial awareness. And I'm flummoxed by it. But I think that's because I have done sports like cycling, where I've ridden in big groups, like soccer, where you have to know where you are and where everyone else is to be successful at it. And I think there's a lot of people that just have never had that dynamic in their lives. Like the grocery store is actually the most group dynamic that they experience.
I really wasn't sure where you were going with this, but I confess 100%.
Right?
100%. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because when I'm there with my boys, I'm constantly coaching them to like not leave the cart in the middle of the aisle. We got to get over to the side. We got to be out of the way. Look, this person's coming through. Let's make room, boys. You know, there are three people in one cart in my little entourage.
Right.
And so to be considerate of others, it requires some management on my part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and absolutely.
For me, part of how I feel good about me is being considerate of others in settings like that.
Well, I'm going to go a step further because the consideration of other people is important to me. But let's set that aside for a moment because not everyone is considerate. Think of it instead as teamwork. I want the things that I want. Mm-hmm. And just the same as I go on a group ride, I want the things that I want. I want a wheel to follow sometimes. I want a challenge sometimes. I want to be on the front sometimes, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to learn the physical politics of the Peloton in order to get the things that you want. And it's the same way at the grocery store. Like, I want a bag of rice. And so there's a dance I have to do with the other people who are getting bags of rice or the soup that's across from the rice or whatever. Like, we working together. We are working together to make this better for everyone. It's the same as driving around in traffic, right? Like, if we all just could think of each other a little bit, you know, I'm not saying you have to be the Mother Teresa of drivers. But if we think of each other a little bit, it works better for everybody. And I think that's kind of the vibe of the Peloton as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you.
We want to become more than the sum of our parts here, right?
Yeah. I just don't have a lot of faith in people generally.
No, but you know, just like in the, like, you and I have joked a number of times, or I have joked to you perhaps, that the number of people I'm willing to go on a group ride with diminishes by one every year, and currently it's at three. You know, you it's hard to go to a big group ride and trust people. You know, you look around and you sort of suss whether they know what they're doing or not, whether they're paying attention, whether they're moving in the space in a way you hope and expect them to.
Yeah.
But the thing is, whether they're doing what they're supposed to or not, you know what you're supposed to do. You got to pay in.
Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like being a shepherd in group rides. That's something I really enjoyed, helping other people learn the ropes, giving somebody a push. If I knew like there was a big acceleration coming and a couple people were likely to get burned off the back, I would at times, you know, position myself in a way to say, hey, here we go. You know, follow me, or I'd give them a push or something.
Right.
I liked helping people acclimate to the rigors of a group ride, just as I like helping the little old lady get that rice bag of rice up high.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm 5'9", so anytime someone at the grocery store asks me to get something up high for them, I'm like, oh, I get to be tall today. That's so nice.
All righty, let's move on to Paceline Picks. What do you got?
I hadn't thought of this previously, but my pick today actually sort of syncs up with the things that we've been saying. So my pick is what I call union dues.
Huh?
Right. So the premise is this. We belong, I think everybody listening, but certainly you and me, we belong, you and I belong to the union of bike riding people. And no matter what kind of bike we ride, we benefit from the work of an advocacy group working to make our riding lives better. So that might be your local trail alliance or your local mountain bike association or your state level cycling advocacy group that works with town and government on bike lanes and other infrastructure. There's a lot of people out there doing the good work, you know? Mm-hmm. Anywhere you put your tires, there are people working for you because they're the active part of the union. If you're not in the active part of the union, you're not doing trail days, or you're not showing up to those meetings, or you're not writing emails, that's fine. But I'd suggest that we should all belong to one or more of these groups.
You don't have to put your shoulder into the effort, but toss a few bucks their way.
Right. So a long time ago, I viewed these groups as kind of the way I view charities. And it was easy for me to say to myself that there were more deserving charities. But they're not charities. They're a lot more like unions. And whether you belong formally or not, you receive union benefits.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's all going to go better out on the road or the trail if these organizations have the resources they need to do what they do, not to mention the people doing the hard work, getting to know that the people who benefit acknowledge and appreciate that work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this week I'm picking union dues. Figure out which union you belong to and ante up. It's cheap, and you've either been drawing benefits a long time already, or you will be drawing them for a long time to come, or both. So I'm not trying to shame you. I'm not saying you're bad if you haven't done it. I'm saying now's the time.
Yeah.
Join the union. Do the thing.
Yeah, cool. Huh, I like that. Yeah. Well, I've made a few trips to the grocery store recently on that aforementioned cargo e-bike.
Yep.
And this week, my pick is the Abus Bordo Granite X Plus lock. I know that's a mouthful. Sorry.
X Plus.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it had to have an X in there somewhere, right? Something's not good until it has an X in the name.
But the X wasn't enough. X Plus.
Well, okay. So I'm going to jump around in what my notes are here. This deserves, if any product from Abus in their lock line deserves an X Plus designation, this would be it. You know,
all right.
10 is not good enough for their security level. Their security level goes to 15. I guess they got to 10 years ago, and then like Shimano and their shoes realized, oh no, we can make it stronger. Uh-huh. And so the Abus Bordo Granite X Plus merits a full 15 points.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's a folding lock made with hardened steel bars. That's, well, much easier to use as a lock for a bike than a traditional U-lock.
Yep.
The bars are 5.5 millimeters thick, and the entire lock is silicone coated to protect the bike's finish.
Yep.
And like I said, 15 out of 15. The lock's design features 6 hinged bars, and it's big enough to fit around a rack, the bike's frame, and front wheel, if you do it just right.
Okay.
I just toss it in the basket of my cargo e-bike and take it to the store with me. And, you know, that lock gives me a peace of mind that I don't think any other lock on the planet has ever given me.
All right.
It's really kind of comic. I don't worry about my bike, even in a town with so much bike theft as Santa Rosa has. Now the lock does come in 2 sizes, 85 centimeters. That's the length of the 6 links altogether.
Right.
And 110 centimeters, for fairly obvious reasons. I think I recommend the bigger 110 centimeter version. It just makes it easier. It's not a cheap lock. It does represent a real investment at about $220 in most outlets. Mm. But it's so much easier than an insurance claim.
Yeah.
I can say this with considerable expertise.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So there will be a lock. There will be a link to the lock in our show notes. That is a wrap on another episode of The Pace Line. We've mentioned a couple of things here worth linking to. There will be links in our show notes. And you can find those at The Cycling Independent.
Our theme music is by Crash Cadet. I went to see some rock and roll with Josh from Crash Cadet just this very week.
Oh, cool.
Our theme music is from their song Bed of Eight. You can find it and them on Bandcamp or wherever you listen to music. Also, big thanks to our friends at Shimano North America for helping us pay the bills. If you want to be a help like them, you can subscribe to TCI or just drop a couple bucks in the tip jar in our online store. No commitment, just good feelings in your tummy for helping us out.
Yeah. Alrighty. Wherever you are, however your day is going, we hope you do get out for a ride. Until next time, I'm Patrick Brady with John Lewis. Thanks for listening to The Paceline.